This is Steve Sherlock with another in the series of internet radio shows or podcasts for Franklin Matters, number 170 in the series. This recording shares the Mobtown Massacre talk by Representative Josh Cutler at the Franklin Historical Museum on Sunday, September 15th, 2019. The presentation document can be found in the show notes, so you can follow along with the audio and the presentation. So without further ado, here is the audio recording, approximately 62 minutes.
So I just want to say thank you to all of you for being here today. We have quite an interesting presentation, and this was a request that we got from Representative Roy's office, and we're always happy to accommodate Jeff with whatever he asks for. This was a good one. I'm just gonna quickly introduce Jeff Roy, our state representative, and let him take it from here. Thank you all for being here.
All right, well, thank you, Mary. Thank you for graciously agreeing to host in this beautiful museum. And I'm glad to see that people are here and comfortable that the Patriots are going to slaughter the Dolphins in the first half, so you really don't need to be there until the second half starts. But that would be great. I am so delighted and honored that Representative Josh Cutler is out here in Franklin to talk about his book, Alexander Hansen and the Mobtown Massacre. Josh is an attorney, and he's a Massachusetts state representative, and he represents the 6th Plymouth District of Massachusetts. And for those of you who don't know by districts, that's all of Pembroke, all of Hanson, and you'll see the connection in a little bit with Hanson, and precincts 2, 3, and 4, 5, and 6 in Duxbury. And Josh was elected to the House of Representatives on November 6th, 2012, which I'm very familiar with because that was the date that I was elected to the State House. Yay! And we came in as freshman classmates together, and you develop a bonding in the legislature with your classmates. There were 16 of us in that original class, and then it grew to about 28 with special elections. But the funny thing is that the House photographer seems to confuse Josh and I, even though I have 10 years on him. He thinks that we look alike, so that my pictures end up in Josh's office and Josh's pictures end up in my office. And the other interesting thing about Josh is that he is the first Democrat to hold the seat for the 6th Plymouth District dating back to the Reconstruction era of the United States of America. And does anybody want to guess who he had to beat in order to get this seat in 2012?
Can I cheat?
Yeah, but you heard it earlier. So.
Daniel Webster.
Right, he had to run against Daniel Webster. But he
not
beat
that
him.
One.
Josh also, before getting to the legislature, he served as the editor and later the publisher of the Duxbury Clipper, which was a family-run newspaper first established by his grandparents in 1950. And he expanded the business, launching new publications, acquiring others, and bringing printing operations in-house. And during his tenure, the Duxbury Clipper earned national recognition as one of New England's top community weeklies. And in addition to more than a dozen journalism honors, Josh has earned distinction as one of Plymouth Business Magazine's top 40 young business leaders. He's the vice chairman of the Joint Committee on Children, Families, and Persons with Disabilities. He serves also on the House Committee on Ways and Means, so when we're looking for money for the town of Franklin, one of my first calls is to Representative Cutler, because Ways and Means provides both the ways and the means to get that money. He's also on the Joint Committee on Higher Education, the Joint Committee on Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy, and the Joint Committee on Ways and Means as well. Graduate of Skidmore College, degree in political science, law degree from Suffolk University Law School, and most recently a master's degree in public policy from UMass Dartmouth. He has two children, also is interested in photography and writing, and just since we are in a local community, I should point out he served on the Board of Selectmen in Hull, the Planning Board in Duxbury, the Alternative Energy Committee in Duxbury, the Pembroke Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors, and the Hanson Kiwanis Board of Directors. And finally, let me tell you that Josh has very graciously is going to sign and sell books at the end of his presentation, but he's donating all of the proceeds from the sales of the books to the Friends of the Franklin Historical Committee. So if you buy a book today, you'll be not only supporting some great writing and some great history, but you're going to be supporting your own historical museum here in Franklin. So with that, as an introduction, I am greatly honored to present to you Representative Josh Cutler.
Thanks, Jeff. You delivered those introductions just like I wrote it, so good job. I'm just kidding. It was an overly gracious introduction, but very kind. It's wonderful to be here in Franklin, to be back here in Franklin, I should say. I've had the pleasure of coming to Franklin in the past to see the very talented Representative Roy play some music as well, right across the street at the Black Box. So it's great to be back. And I want to thank the folks here at the Historical Society Museum. I want to thank Mary, Kai, Sandy, who so kindly helped out with all the arrangements. And really want to just, again, thank Representative Roy. It's truly, he's a great friend, he's a great legislator. I think you guys all know that. We came in together as freshman legislators, and so we do develop a bond. And he has been someone who has really earned the respect of course, myself, but all of his colleagues in the legislature. And really, Jeff is someone who I can't pay a higher praise or compliment than saying that he is someone who's intellectually curious. And I think what he's doing today, his involvement here in local history, he is really someone who wants to learn and believes in lifelong learning. So I'm proud to call Jeff a friend and a colleague, and very thankful that he's been so generous to welcome me here again today. So we're gonna have a little fun, okay? I got a presentation here we're gonna go through. Happy to answer some questions at the end. Have some books we're gonna sign if anyone would like. And again, we're donating all the proceeds back to wherever I go, I donate the proceeds back to the local historical societies or museums and so forth. So looking forward to that. So are we all good? Any questions before we start? All right, let's dive in. So what are we talking about here? Do we want to dim the lights? Can folks see, or is that? So Alexander Hanson and the Mob Town Massacre. And again, we want to thank our gracious hosts here. So what was the Mob Town Massacre, and why should we care? All right, let's start with that. What's most notable about the Mob Town Massacre was that it was the first fatal attack in the nation's history on the free press. And sadly, we hear even, you know, just recently, and I'm gonna talk about some historical parallels a little bit later, but we see this is continuing to happen throughout our nation's history, but this was the very first time it had happened, and so we're gonna get into the details of that. But that is perhaps what is most significant about this event. And what it was more literally is it was a bloody riot at the Baltimore City Jail during the summer of 1812. And I know we have a lot of history folks here. You probably know there was something going on in the world or the United States in 1812, the War of 1812, which played a key role in what was about to happen here in Baltimore. And this was all provoked by a gentleman named Alexander Hanson, who I'm going to talk about in a moment, who actually the town of Hanson, which I am proud to represent, was named after. And there's some nice connections between the Hanson family and Benjamin Franklin, who the town of Franklin was named after. We'll get to those in a second, too. That's called a tease. So, all right. So it was provoked by his newspaper, and a partisan mob violently attacked Hanson after he published some anti-administration editorials. And he and a small band of men took up arms to defend the newspaper. So in short, that is the Mob Town Massacre. So let's dive in and have some fun here. The aftermath of this had some major ripple effects, not just in the state of Maryland, but really across the nation at the time, and influenced the course of the War of 1812. So who was Alexander Conti Hanson, Jr.? because he was a junior. This is a photo. There's only two images that we have of him. This is him as a younger man. And briefly, a little bit about him. He was born in 1786 in Annapolis, Maryland. He graduated from nearby St. John's College. He was admitted to the bar. He practiced law for a short period of time. And he married married Priscilla Dorsey in 1805. This is a picture of Priscilla. And shortly thereafter, he launched his first newspaper in 1808. Funny quick story, he was a brash young man throughout his whole life, and the story goes that when he met Priscilla, she was 16 and living with guardians in the city of Baltimore. Her parents had passed away, and young Alexander Hansen came courting, and apparently they didn't approve of Hansen, and the guardians refused to assent to the courtship. And so they actually eloped, which was something very unusual at the time. Hansen and Priscilla escaped and traveled to Annapolis by carriage, and they got married there. So the brash young Hansen charted his course. Who is Alexander Hansen, and why do we know the Hansen family? And for folks who are really up on their trivia, if I ask you, who was one of the first early presidents of the United States, you would of course say, you know, George Washington. But if I said before him, who would you say? And you might answer John Hansen, who was Alexander Hansen's grandfather. And he was one of the presidents of the United States during the Articles of Confederation. So he was more akin to a sort of Speaker of the House, but his official title was actually President of the United States in Congress Assembled. So pre-U.S. Constitution, during the Articles of Confederation, he was one of the nation's first quote-unquote presidents. So you might be able to win a bet at a bar on that one. An interesting connection here that John Hansen, so again Alexander Hansen's grandfather, was a friend of Benjamin Franklin. And in fact, he appointed Benjamin Franklin to go to France in 1783, to help negotiate the treaty with France. Later on, when Hansen passed away, Ben Franklin was at his funeral. So they very much were contemporaries, and I thought that was a neat little connection to the town here of Franklin. So that's John Hansen. Alexander Conte Hansen Sr. was Hansen's father, and he was a prominent Maryland judicial figure as well. So, came from a very prominent family. So Hansen launched his newspaper, as I said, in 1808. It was called the Federal Republican. And I just want to pause for a minute because it gets a little confusing. The political parties, obviously today we have Democrats and Republicans. Back then you had Federalists, and you had the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, Democratic Republican Party. So essentially what we used to call the Democratic Republican Party eventually became, it bumps along the way, became the Democratic Party. But at the time, the Democratic Republican Party, which was the party of Jefferson, the party of Madison, was very different and not at all connected to our modern day Republican Party. So I'm going to use the word Republican Party today, but this is the Democratic Republican Party has no connection to the modern day Republican Party. I know that's a little confusing. And to make it even more confusing, Hansen, who was a very strongly believed in federalism, so he was a federalist, he called his newspaper the Federal Republican. So that gets a little confusing, but he was a federalist. He was very much against the Republicans, but his newspaper was called the Federal Republican. So he launched the paper in 1808. It was came out 6 days a week, so you could buy a subscription for $7 a year. And he also had a country edition for $5 a year. Now, Hansen had a penchant for stirring up trouble. He was, this is a political cartoon that he did. I don't know if you can see that, but it's a political cartoon he did of President Madison, who was on the little animal there. And he depicted him as a monkey, referring to him as the little man in the White House. And this is sort of a good example of kind of Hansen's tone. He was very bitter and caustic, and he very much spared no punches when he went after his political foes. And in fact, as one might expect, His penchant for stirring up trouble got himself in a little bit of trouble, and...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's the 10 dual commandments.
All right, so of course that's from
Hamilton.
All right, so this is a depiction of Alexander Hansen's duel in 1805, which obviously has nothing to do with Alexander Hansen, but for the fact that dueling was a very frequent custom at the time to settle political scores. And so what happened with Alexander Hansen is that he wrote an article that was very disparaging about an incident that happened. It was the USS Chesapeake, if anybody knows about the Chesapeake debacle. It was a Navy frigate that was forced to surrender to a British warship in 1807. It helped precipitate a trade embargo, and Hansen wrote a column disparaging the captain and the commander of the ship, blaming him for what had happened. The Navy captain wasn't too pleased with this. His name was Charles Gordon, and he later decided to challenge Hansen to a duel. And so, flash forward, the men finally met on these dueling grounds in Bladensburg, Maryland, which is just outside the Washington, D.C. line, which is depicted here, in 1810. And so Gordon was a naval officer. He was an experienced shot, and he might have thought that he was facing up against some avuncular newspaper editor. But he, unfortunately, he would be sadly mistaken. The two men met, they marched off their five paces, turned to each other. Gordon was a little bit slow to lift his pistols, and Hansen got off his shot first, and quote unquote, according to one witness, with marvelous coolness and nonchalance, got off his shot. Gordon was struck in the abdomen right above his hip bone, and he fell to the ground. He survived, but the wound left him disabled for the rest of his life. So anybody guess what that music's from? Tchaikovsky's War of 1812. All right, I figured that'd be appropriate, so we're talking about the 1812. And it helps to set the scene a little bit because, so again, we're talking about what's happening on the national scene, or the, you know, the larger scene in the world at that time is France and England are warring. And the Federalists, Alexander Hansen's Federalists, were allied with England, Mother England, whereas the Democratic Republicans, the Republicans were allied with France. And that mirrored, that sort of chasm was mirrored on the local level as well. So June 18th, 1812, President James Madison declares war against Great Britain. It was the first declared war in the nation's history. You may have heard the term free trade and sailors' rights. That was sort of the rallying cry that was used as the reason for the war. But the war was, the vote for war was actually very closely divided at the time. Many folks, Federalists, mostly in New England and also in the Mid-Atlantic, were vigorously opposed to the war and argued that the nation was really ill-prepared for another foreign entanglement, especially one against Great Britain, then the greatest naval power in the world. Republicans, the Democratic Republicans as they were known, generally supported the war and felt the nation had little choice given the British tariffs, attacks on American sailors, and the incitement of Native Americans along the western frontier. So, President Madison declared war on June 18th, 1812, and of course, Alexander Hansen had something to say about this. He was in the city of Baltimore at the time, publishing his newspaper, and so 2 days after this formal declaration, he published an editorial on the back of his two-page newspaper. This is the actual editorial here. The first part of it read, "Thou hast done a deed whereat valor will weep. Without funds, without taxes, without an army, navy, or adequate fortifications, our rulers have promulgated a war against the clear and decided sentiments of a vast majority of the nation." That was the start of his editorial. It was very brief. It was only a few hundred words, 450 words to be exact. But Hansen really unloaded on President Madison, the administration, and their decision to plunge forward into war. Now, at the time, the city of Baltimore was a hotbed of Democratic Republican support. So here is Alexander Hansen, the Federalist, the hardcore, true believer Federalist, chose to publish his newspaper in perhaps the one place in America at the time that was the most anti-Federalist, and that was the city of Baltimore. And so you can imagine these words did not go over well in Baltimore. And in fact, So the editorial came out on a Saturday, and over the weekend, people started meeting immediately to plan and plot revenge against Hansen to silence he and his newspaper. And so, actually, Sunday morning, folks met in what's called the Fells Point area of Baltimore, if anyone's been, which was the Maritime area, and they met at local beer gardens and taverns, and they plotted how they could shut down the newspaper. So the next day on Monday, so literally this all happened within the course of just a few days, war is declared, Hansen prints his newspaper editorial 2 days later, and then 2 days after that, on a Monday evening, a small mob of men gathers outside of the newspaper office in the heart of Old Town Baltimore, and they attack, and they start, they have fire hooks, ropes, axes, and they begin to attack the building, a three-story wooden structure, and basically tear it down to the ground. Hansen himself was not in Baltimore at the time. He was actually back home. He lived in the suburbs, or we wouldn't call them suburbs then, but in Rockville, Maryland. He lived outside of the city about a day's horse ride away. And so he wasn't injured during the attack. His business partner was in Baltimore at the time and just narrowly escaped an injury by taking the company books out of the office just hours before the attack. So this first attack happened, and the city of Baltimore, really for the next week to 2 weeks, violence overtook the city. And it started off as political combatants, but it really became general melee of violence. Violence against African Americans happened especially. And so the city of Baltimore was really under siege for a period of 2 weeks subsequent to this first attack. So Hansen's back home. He learns about the attack very quickly. And of course, he's not the kind of guy to be intimidated. He's very dedicated to what he believes is his true cause, which is to oppose this unjust war and to defend the right of the free press to express itself. And so he decides, rather than going away or maybe moving the newspaper, he decides he's going to go back to Baltimore, and this time he's going to recruit a band of Federalist loyalists to help him, so that if he's attacked again, they can defend themselves. So Hansen recruits some of the top luminaries at the time in the Federalist Party.
First in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, he was second to none in the humble and endearing scenes of private life.
Anybody know who these talk? Who is he talking about? Anybody guess? First in war, first in peace was, of course,
George Washington,
right. Famous eulogy of President Washington. The man who said those words was, you can guess, Light Horse Harry Lee, who was a famous general. He had served with Hansen's late father. He was a well-known Federalist and military veteran. He had won a surprise victory during the Revolutionary War with his adroit horsemanship, which is why he was called Light Horse Harry Lee. And he famously gave the eulogy to President Washington. He was also the father of Robert E. Lee. So Light Horse Harry Lee was one of Hansen's recruits. Another one of his recruits was a gentleman named James Lingen, pictured in the center here, who was also a Revolutionary War hero, and in fact he had spent over a year on a British prison ship after he was captured. He was confined in a very small space, and the story goes that afterwards, when he was freed, he couldn't extend his arms to sleep, and he had to sleep in a chair. That was the only way he was comfortable to sleep. So he was viewed as another Federalist war hero. So these are the two senior statesmen on the left that Hansen had enlisted to help him defend his newspaper. And the final one was more of a contemporary of Hansen. He was a younger man named John Howard Payne. And he later became famous for a completely different reason, which maybe some of you may recognize. Together. No Place Like Home. Anyone, I'm sure some of you are familiar with that. A famous, famous ballad. John Howard Payne he wrote that ballad, later became very famous. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He hadn't written that at the time. He was still a very young man, but he went on to do that. So just an interesting kind of historical tidbit. So he was a friend of Hansen's, and Hansen actually helped launch his career when he was a young man in doing drama. So these are some of the men that Hansen recruited to help go back to Baltimore with him to defend the free press. There were about two dozen men in all, and in fact, they later became known as the Spartan Band. And this is a list of folks that were in the original group. And what's interesting here, this is a letter that was written by a Baltimore resident and sent to a friend overseas with a list of all of the of Hansen's faction, as it was called. And you can see General Henry Lee of Virginia and many other names there. The author of the letter wasn't very sympathetic to the cause, and we know that because he called the men bravados from Montgomery County. So, the first attack happened June 22nd. About a month later, Hansen and his men returned to Baltimore. They took up site at a three-story brick home, which was located in Old Town Baltimore. This is a map of the city of Baltimore at the time. Here's a close-up of where the street was. It was on Charles Street. If anyone's been to Baltimore, Charles Street's still there. You can walk down. And so the men found their space on Charles Street. They brought their supplies, their fortifications. They brought in some ammunitions. But they tried, by Hansen's direction, to be very quiet about what they were doing. They didn't want to alert the neighbors and let them know that they were moving in here. And in fact, the story goes, they brought in a keg of gunpowder, but had it marked as crackers in order to throw off the nosy neighbors. Yeah. And they brought in 20 muskets, other weapons. They brought in stones to use as projectiles. They barricaded the doors and windows, and they sort of were loaded for bear. So they were going to publish the new edition of the newspaper from this new space on Charles Street, right in the city, right at downtown Baltimore. And so they moved in over the weekend. So Hansen arrived on a Friday. Some of the men came on Saturday. They did their fortifications over the weekend, and by Monday, the new edition of the newspaper was to be published and distributed. So again, the paper had taken a bit of a hiatus while they had tried to repair the building. And so the new edition was to be published, and then it would be delivered in the city of Baltimore on Monday morning. And the Federalists, they anticipated there might be some problems after what had happened before. Here's the new edition of the paper. You can't really see it from there, but Hansen wrote another editorial that was even more incendiary than the first one, and he said, quote, "A mobocracy. 5 weeks have elapsed since the suspension of this journal. The outrages of the mob, implicitly sanctioned, if not originated, by the highest authorities in the country," and he's talking about President Madison here, "are resolvable into a single point, a daring and desperate attempt to intimidate and overawe the minority to destroy the freedom of speech and of the press." And this was just the beginning of a very lengthy editorial that he published in the paper, attacking the city for the way it had handled the first riot and sort of doubling down on all his rhetoric before about how the war was an unjust war. So you can imagine what happened. This was Monday. By Monday evening, so only a few short hours later, the newspaper was circulated around the city, and instantly people had a visceral reaction as soon as they learned that Hansen was back with his newspaper. And so at dusk, a small group of boys gathered outside the house. They made cat calls at first, and the noise kind of attracted some more older men who were watching, and the crowds quickly grew larger. And eventually, instead of just hurling cat calls, they started hurling stones and rocks at the Federalists inside inside the house. One of the Federalists described the scene later on this way. "By 8 o'clock, a herd of Irishmen, Frenchmen, and ragamuffins had congregated and commenced a most violent attack upon the house. Some stones had been thrown at intervals before, but now they came in volleys. Windows and sashes and shutters were demolished in an instant, whilst bricks and paving stones were flying about our heads with the most tremendous crash." Hansen himself spoke from the second floor window of the house. He yelled down to the crowd and said the house was his castle, and he would defend it, and he warned that he had a lawful right to occupy it and defend it, and that he would attack if the mob attacked him. and he would be compelled to fire upon them. But the mob was not intimidated. They replied, according to one witness, "Tear the damn Tory out of his castle. Break open the door." In response to the barrage, the Federalists decided to fire a warning shot over the heads of the crowd. But this did not work, and the rioters yelled back, "Fire, fire, you damn Tories, fire. We are not afraid of you." Overnight, the mob grew much, much larger as news unfolded. And we know a little bit about who was in the mob from court records. And one of the leading rioters was a gentleman who we don't have any photos of. His name was Dr. Thaddeus Gale. He was actually a Frenchman. He was over 50 years old. He was had recently arrived in Baltimore. He was an itinerant physician in New England, actually. And he was described as lank and pale. He actually had written a book on the use of electroshock therapy. It was one of the first treaties on electroshock therapy, although he was viewed as something of a quack at the time. So he was one of the leading rioters, and we know this based on some of the criminal dockets of the folks who were later charged in the attacks. Many of the folks were Irish, there were some German, many came from Fells Point, which was the home, maritime area of the city, home to many recent immigrants. It's interesting, one of the men, this is a classified ad right here from a man named Kenelon White, and he was actually a member of the city militia, but he joined the mob, and he later on took out this classified ad in the newspaper to protest his innocence, that he wasn't involved, although he was specifically identified in a lot of the court documents, but you can see it's kind of funny that he would take that step. So the mob gathered overnight. There were, by many accounts, more than 1,000 people gathered outside in the streets in the city of Baltimore. And eventually, the city leaders, the mayor and the general of the local militia decided they just could not protect the home from the mob. As you can imagine, the city of Baltimore, you know, everyone, 90% of the populace was politically aligned with the Democratic Republican Party. They're very unhappy that this Federalist newspaper was in their city, was publishing these incendiary comments, and they felt that they had provoked this attack, and so there was very little sympathy for defending them, and the rule of law was not such as it is today, or as we hope it is today. And so the mayor and city leaders decided that they couldn't protect the house, so they decided to move the Federalists to the local city jail. That's the only place they felt they would be protected. And so they did. Hansen didn't think this was a good idea. He didn't trust the city leaders to protect them. He thought as soon as they tried to leave the house, they'd be attacked, and they were. And he fought with his other Federalists, including Light Horse Harry Lee, about whether they should do this. He felt it was surrendering to them. But ultimately, because the night wore on, they were losing supplies, men were getting fatigued, frustrated, they really had no other choice. So they did agree to be escorted to the city jail for their own protection. And so the next morning, that's what happened. A large scrum of militia circled the men, and they made their way about a mile down the city to the city jail, which is depicted here on the bottom. Up top is a picture of the city penitentiary. So the men were escorted into a 20-foot cell with a bare oak floor and a pair of stools. The outer door had a thick metal grating, allowing the prisoners to see out into the yard. Once inside, the Federalists breathed a sigh of relief. You know, they felt like they were finally free, finally safe, excuse me. The mob couldn't get to them, and they were relieved. Some of them actually took some time to actually catch up on their sleep because they'd been up all night. Alas, 'twas not to be. A gentleman who later would be known as Mama the Butcher, his name was John Mama, and he was a meat butcher, found his way inside the jail. Obviously, security is a little bit different than it would be today, and so he was able to get inside the jail, and the men saw him. His name was John Mama, he's called Mama the Butcher. He's an intimidating man, and they wondered, you know, what was he doing? And it turns out he was basically on a recon mission for the mob. And so later on that day, around dusk, When the militia had left the jail, the mob struck again, and a group of men came up from Fell's Point, and they rushed to the jail, and there wasn't really any much, there were very few guards protecting them, and they broke through the outer barriers, got inside the jail. There's some conflicting reports about whether the door was actually left open for them by one of the sympathetic jail keeps, but they got inside the jail, and they were able to break in to the cells where Hansen and his Spartan band were being kept. There were about 20 of them by then. What happened next was described in a later report as a scene of horror and murder ensued, which for its barbarity has no parallel in the history of the American people. And that perhaps could be a bit of hyperbole, but what happened next was quite gruesome. And so I'm not going to get too deep into the actual massacres, that's why you buy the book. What's notable here is that, again, these folks, these Democratic Republican loyalists were attacking Hansen. They didn't, they felt that they really detested the Federalists, felt they provoked this attack. They believed strongly in the war, the spirit of patriotism had sort of taken over the city, and yet, they attacked James Lingan, who was one of the gentlemen who I was talking about, introduced earlier, who was a hero. Think about this. He was a hero of the Revolutionary War. So he had valiantly fought against the British to help make America free from the British. And yet here he was being attacked and being called a pawn of the British by these Republican mob attackers. And in fact, Lingan, James Lingan was killed during the attack, becoming the very first man ever killed in defense of the free press in the nation's history. The mob members, after they had killed Lingan and after they quite gruesomely attacked Hansen and all of his Federalist allies, they started chanting the following chant: "We'll feather and tar every damned British Tory, and this for American glory." So if you think about the fact that they were attacking these British, these heroes, American heroes who had fought against the British, and then chanting anti-British, choosing the anti-British sentiment, it's really remarkable. The massacre went on all night. Hansen barely escaped with his life. His colleague James Lingan was killed. Lighthouse Harry Lee was very gravely injured. In fact, he never recovered fully from his injuries. And the next morning, as news of this massacre spread in the city of Baltimore, everything kind of grinded to a halt. The mayor issued a curfew. The grand jury decided to recess and leave the city. Some Federalists felt it wasn't a safe place to be at all and left. This is a proclamation from the mayor setting a curfew. And then news of the attack slowly circulated outside of the city and immediately became viewed in a very partisan way. For Federalists, they used it as a rallying cry for a political cub to a wedgel to use against their political enemies. The Republicans felt it was that the Federalists had provoked this attack. And so very quickly became a political hot potato. And here we have a good example in Boston, in Quincy Hall, at Quincy Market. This flyer was distributed shortly after the attack with the headline there, "Baltimore Mob to Destroy the Freedom of Speech and of the Press." So in New England, where Federalists were very much in the majority, they looked at this with horror, what had happened in the city of Baltimore, and tried to use it to their political advantage. One of the first newspaper articles right here in the Trenton Federalist a couple days later used the headline "Mobs, Butchery, and Murder," and first referred to the city of Baltimore as Mob Town, which actually, if anyone's been, it actually still to this day is referred to as Mob Town because of this incident. So the Federalists were obviously quite upset, not just in the city of Baltimore, but throughout the country, and they tried to rally in support. And in fact, many of them took out subscriptions in the newspaper as a way of showing their support for Hansen and his cause. And in fact, one gentleman who took out a subscription was an elderly gentleman, then I believe 77 years old, you may recall, Paul Revere. And this is a subscription receipt that he paid $10 for a copy of the Federal Republican to show his support for Hansen and his cause. So the aging revolutionary hero was still very much engaged. That was pretty cool. So Hansen, for all his efforts, was rewarded by being charged with manslaughter. So he and his compatriots were charged with the deaths of a couple of the people who had attacked the house were killed during the attack, and so Hansen was charged with manslaughter along with a dozen other of his Federalist allies. This is a court copy of the docket sheet here, and this is the courthouse in Annapolis, Maryland, where the trial actually occurred. Hansen was succeeded in having his case remanded from Baltimore to Annapolis, or he probably wouldn't have escaped with his life. And the Federalists were actually found not guilty after a very quick trial. As you can imagine, this case drew a ton of attention across the nation. Hansen became a hero, a Federalist hero. Dinners and lavish balls were held to fete him. Toasts were given to his heroism, defending the Federalists, defending the rights of the free press, speaking out against the war. He drew many favorable comparisons to Alexander Hamilton, another Federalist hero, and he was called a vanguard of the new generation of Federalist heroes. There was even a traveling waxwork exhibit that had an image of Hansen that traveled around New England. Hansen used his catapulted him to Washington, D.C. He was elected to the United States Congress. One thing, this is interesting. This is a copy of the court docket from Hansen's trial. And during the trial, before the lawyers were allowed to make their arguments, they both had to swear and affirm their oath to the Christian religion. That was interesting. That was actually part of the court process back then. So Hansen was elected to Congress from Maryland's district here, and this is what the Congress looked like at the time. And so he went off to Congress to serve, to bring his fight to defend the free press and wage his crusade against the war to Congress. And at the time, you know, he was quite a well-known figure in American history at the time. Today, no one really knows anything about him, but his career looked like it was on an arc to really become one of the titans of the early 19th century. And alas, it did not happen. Hansen's career never did really take off. He did become one of the youngest. He was elected to the Congress, and then he was elected to the United States Senate. Became one of the youngest senators in the United States history. Again, as I said, he was once celebrated as a rising star and a Federalist hero. He and Daniel Webster, not the one I ran against, but the original Daniel Webster, were once mentioned in the same breaths as the new generation of Federalist heroes who were going to lead the Federalist cause over the next generation. But it didn't work out that way. He grew disillusioned. He was a true believer. And he felt that even some in his party who had more moderate views, that he felt they were traitors to the cause. And he was truly a true believer, an uncompromising man. And as time wore on, he grew very disillusioned. I think he was suffered from depression. He may have, based on his letters that I've read. He actually caused a rift in his own Federalist Party, and at one point caused a faction to split off from the Federalist Party. As folks know, the Federalist Party, which doesn't exist today, very soon thereafter sort of faded from the national scene. And so his career kind of was on this trajectory, and then it went like that. And he turned to farming and agricultural pursuits. He had a home and estate in Maryland. And he still served in the United States Senate, but he wasn't able to really keep up the same level of vibrancy and dedication that he had, primarily because of his physical woes, and a lot of that dated back to the injuries that he sustained during the attack. In fact, during one speech, very prominent speech he gave on war financing later on, I believe in 1817, he was a senator then. He got up to deliver a speech, and you know, you think we talk a long time now, but back then, you know, you'd have a 2 or 3 hour speech. And so Hansen got up to speak, and he spoke for a good 2.5 hours. He sat back down and started spitting up blood. He never really recovered from the attack. So he died at the age of 33. He has a young man in relative obscurity on his farm in Elkridge, Maryland. The other couple interesting notes about some of his colleagues. Light Horse Harry Lee never recovered from his injuries either. He actually traveled to Barbados in the West Indies trying to hoping that the warmer climate would help to help soothe his many injuries. It didn't really work. And after 5 years, he decided he wanted to go back to his home, to his family, and he boarded a ship and made it as far as the coast of Georgia in 1818. He got off, and he essentially succumbed to his injuries and never got to see his family or his young son, Robert E. Lee, again. James Lingen was the gentleman who was killed during the attack. He later became very well known, and in fact, in 1996, the dedication of the Freedom Forum to slain journalists in Washington, D.C. He was the very first etched glass panel that was put up at the monument. In fact, then First Lady Hillary Clinton spoke at the dedication, and she said, "When James Lingen was killed defending his newspaper's printing press from a mob in 1812, America was a young nation. We were still learning how to be a true democracy." The interesting note for me and for us is that the small town of Hanson, which I represent next down on the South Shore, was then at that time was part of another town called Pembroke, and they had split off. And the town was looking for, the folks in the town wanted to have their own town, so they petitioned the legislature and they granted them a township. And because Massachusetts at the time was very much a federalist state, very strong federal support, they decided to name the town after Hanson as a tribute to Alexander Hanson. And so Hanson, Massachusetts stands as one of the really only markers of the career, the bright, incandescent, but brief career of Alexander Hanson. And that's it. Thank you. So I'd be happy, if folks have questions or just a discussion, I'd be happy to engage in that. It's really been a joy for me to be able to share a little bit of this story, and I kind of apologize, I've gone quickly in some parts because it's a long story, and of course the book can tell it in more depth, but it's really been a great joy for me to be able to learn about this local history and how, you know, one community in Massachusetts got to be named after a Federalist newspaper editor from Maryland, and to see all the parallels. And I'll just tell one quick little side note. That I did learn during my research is that Hanson may very well have traveled through this area, perhaps even here in Franklin. In 1813, he actually traveled up here to New England and to Massachusetts. As you might imagine, he was a big hero up here. We viewed him as a great Federalist hero. He was fighting the free press and those barbarians down in Maryland and Baltimore. And so he came up here, and he was feted at the time, and he met with, you know, some of the state's top leaders. Josiah Quincy brought him around, showed him the city. And in fact, the men then traveled down to the town of Hingham, and they took a packet ship out and did some fishing out in Hingham Harbor. I have some letters that show that. And then they journeyed back through New Bedford and eventually went back down towards Connecticut. So it's very likely he may have come through or had to come through part of this area, which is kind of cool. So again, I thank you very much for sitting through, and I'd be happy to have, if folks have a curiosity about anything or have questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Representative.
I have two questions.
Yes.
One, interested in him being becoming a senator, and I understand that at the time senators were appointed by the legislature,
right.
And if he was so unpopular, I'm curious as to how he got appointed. And the second one is if you could share with us where you did your research.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So to the first part, so he was very unpopular. Because of what happened, the election of 1812 really served to shift what the political landscape. And so what happened after the election of 1812 in the state of Maryland, the legislature actually flipped. And so it had been in Democratic-Republican hands, but primarily because of this incident and the war was very unpopular at the time. And today we look back and, you know, it's, you know, we know about Andrew Jackson at Battle of New Orleans, but if you think back at the time, it was very unpopular. And so the political tide really shifted, and the Federalist Party retook the House of Delegates in the state of Maryland. And in fact, it actually came fairly close to unseating President Madison. It was one of the closest elections in history at the time. So that's why he was able to be appointed to serve in the Senate, but great question. As far as my research, so I think I was first told when I, maybe 10 years ago when I was first getting involved in politics, that the town of Hanson was named after this newspaper editor from Maryland. I was like, that's kind of weird. Why would that happen? And so, you know, learned a little bit more about it and thought that was kind of interesting. And I'd always wanted to do something more about it. And then finally, about 5 years ago, I decided, okay, it was a New Year's resolution, actually. I decided I'm gonna take this on. And so I dug in. And as soon as I was able to kind of learn more, you know, as you know, you learn a little scrap here and you pick up some more information here and it just snowballs. And it turns out that one of the neat things about the book that I'm able to do is there were over 80 depositions from eyewitnesses that were taken during this actual massacre. And so we can reconstruct with almost, you know, precision conversations that happened back 200 plus years ago, blow-by-blow accounts of what happened during these attacks and who said what and who was where, because of these 80 plus eyewitness depositions. And they were all preserved. That's, you know, the importance of local history. They were all preserved at the time by the Maryland Historical Society. And so I was able to read all those, and they really allowed me to pursue the book, because otherwise it would be hard to tell the story without that kind of historical record. So it goes to say how important it is what you're doing today to record our history today. I'll be so important to our future generations. But that was really what made it easy, and I traveled to Baltimore a number of times. They have some great historical societies in Baltimore and Maryland, and it was a lot of fun. And the gentleman here?
You already answered my question.
Oh, okay, great. I'm glad. Yes?
How many people actually died in the massacre?
So, three people actually died, and in fact, it's a funny little side note, I went to Baltimore to do some talks, and folks are a little defensive, I would say, about this, because it's sort of viewed as, you know, this is a negative point in the history of the city. And I remember one gentleman who came, was very upset with me that I called it a massacre, and he said he didn't think it should be called a massacre because not enough people had been killed. And my response was that the number of people who were killed isn't really what makes something a massacre. It was the level of barbarity and cruelty that occurred. Which I sort of skipped over some of that, but there was some pretty gruesome stuff. People dripping hot candle wax into the eyes of the Federalists. Yeah, so it's early on a Sunday, so we didn't need that. So it was quite barbaric what they did, and so I called it an Uptown Massacre. And so not everyone was happy with that title. I think it's fair.
Some people died as a result of wounds.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Oh, right, and I mean, Alexander Hanson never recovered. General Lighthorse Harry Lee never recovered. And I like to think about the pivot points in history that might, you know, so Lighthorse Henry Lee, he never saw his son again. Robert E. Lee was a young man, a young boy when his father left, and he never saw him again. And there's some interesting letters that he writes to his young son trying to give him guidance and wisdom. And it's just really fascinating to think about, you know, the what ifs of history.
In one of your early slides, there was a picture of somebody being tied and feathered ridden out of town on a rail, and you mentioned something about tar and feathering. Did anyone actually get tar?
Yes,
and feathering?
Yeah, a gentleman named John Thompson. He was one of the Federalist prisoners. He was tarred and feathered, and at the time, so tarring and feathering was viewed as more of a form of, not so much, well, it was obviously very painful, but it's more of embarrassment than intended to kill someone. But he was very brutally, so they tarred and feathered him. They brought him to a local pub, and they actually started to hang him. And then one person spoke up, and they decided they would let him live. They dragged him through the city naked, and it was quite quite a gruesome scene. But yeah, so yeah, he was tarred and feathered. They tried to tar and feather Hansen, but Hansen was able to escape and get out of the jail before that happened. Did I see another hand? Yeah.
Down in the city of Baltimore, are there any, is he celebrated in any way? Or?
Yeah, so there's one on right near the site of the house on Charles Street. There is one plaque, I would say, a little marker. They have, the city of Baltimore has these little historical plaques throughout the city, and there is one that talks about this incident. There's also the mayor of the city. It's interesting that, and if you read the book, the mayor is kind of a villain in some ways, because he didn't really stand up to the mob, and he didn't defend Hansen or the press. But today he's viewed as a hero because he did some other things in the city, and the general, just got a gentleman named General John Stricker, who was the head of the city militia, and he basically didn't lift a finger to help Hansen. He sent his militia home. He refused to help out. I think he truly let down his city. But today he is viewed as a hero as well, because he later on fought in the War of 1812 and did some things that sort of renovated his image. So there is, I don't want to say that they haven't acknowledged it, but there is, he is acknowledged. It's just not, I wouldn't say it's well advertised. Yeah.
So after this, Welch, any more attempts on attacking press down there?
Yeah, so actually, two things. Thank you for the great question. One is, it's a very sort of sad footnote. So I mentioned that in 1996, First Lady Hillary Clinton spoke at the dedication of the Freedom Forum Museum, and where General Lincoln was put up as the very first slain American defending the free press. A reporter at the time, his name was Rob Hassan, was a reporter for, I think, the Baltimore Sun at the time. And he wrote the news story covering this event, and that's how actually, when I did my research, I came across the news story. And so it became part of my research. His name was Rob Hassan, and that was in 1996. And as it turns out, there was a deadly attack on the Capitol Gazette in the state of Maryland last year, and I believe six journalists were killed, and one of them was Rob Hassan. So the journalist who wrote about the attack, the first attack on the free press, was killed in an attack. So it's really awful. But I guess it just kind of shows that this things have not changed.
I was wondering if
in terms of that, so it did. I mean, and there were many incidents that happened, some ripple effects, and in fact. Near us, in the town of Plymouth, a Republican congressman was attacked. So, sort of the Democrats retaliated. He wasn't killed, but a Republican congressman who actually then represented the area where I live was attacked about a month after this because of the Democrats. Excuse me, the Federalists were very upset and they retaliated. So it did spur other violence, unfortunately. Yeah. One of the notes that I found. Is an overriding theme. I think we tend to think of today, things are so bad, politics is so awful, the two sides are just so pitted against each other. And number one, certainly not true in the Massachusetts legislature, but on a broader point of view, I think it's in a way, it's always been that way. And, the Federalists and the Republicans, they were at each other, and it was very vicious, and they did terrible things to each other. And we sometimes look back at the good old days, but I don't think that's necessarily always true. So one more? Yeah, Kai.
When they agreed to be moved from the press to prison in basically self-defense, and then, am I correct that they were then responsible for the riot in the
Yep.
So then they were there for defense and they were attacked, yet they were put on trial for the murder of the attackers.
Yep. That's pretty much it, yeah.
And so in your book, Do you address how that trial was targeted against them and the resulting acquittal later on?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, so as I mentioned briefly, Hansen, the federal succeeded in having the case transferred to Annapolis. If they'd been tried in Baltimore, they would have been found guilty. There's no doubt about it. And so cooler heads, you know, did prevail in that sense, and the case was transferred to Annapolis, which was the capital, which was still somewhat hostile to Federalists, but less so than Baltimore. And there they were acquitted. We don't have a lot of court records, but I did have the docket sheet from the trial itself that shows what they did. And Hansen really, it was a slam dunk. I mean, I think they had put on 17 defense witnesses. The jury never left the jury box and decided they were not guilty. And it was, I think Hansen kind of used it as a way to kind of show that, stick it to the people in Baltimore. Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention, so these are some copies of the Federal Republican newspaper, some original copies. I thought I'd just pass around that, just try to keep them in the thing. I think it's kind of cool. Kind of cool to see the newspapers from back then. These are from 1812, 1813. Just really interesting to take a look at it. Yeah. I know, you didn't have it. So I'll just leave you with this. So I have copies of the book. 100% of the money is going back to, I was donated back to wherever I was speaking. So in this case, the Friends of the Franklin Historical Museum. I have about a dozen copies here. I'd be glad to sign them. If folks also can get it on Amazon and any of those online booksellers as well. So again, thank you so much for doing this. Hopefully the Patriots won. Thank you.
Thank you to John Josh, and thank you all for coming. This is the type of thing that we want to do as a community, to get people into the museum and education, historical education. And this was an excellent topic and very interesting. Thank you so much.
How's it doing, man?
This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but I can't do it alone. I can always use your help. How can you help? Overall, if you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like this, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements, and I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy.